leave and go to another room and come back. We'll cooperate with everybody and make sure that if you want to testify, we'll have an opportunity to do that, and we'll be very patient with that. I do ask that you limit your comments to a reasonable period of time so that the committee can get a sense for what you're saying. I'll say, as the sponsor of Senate Bill 742, and I'm going to move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 742, that the original idea was a relatively simple one. It clearly has drawn a lot of criticism. The idea originally was to have a single statute dealing with the issue of terrorism as opposed to various statutory constructs dealing with ecoterrorism or bioterrorism or terrorism related to forestry and so on and so forth, which has historically been occurring within the legislature. The bill was drafted, unfortunately, overly broad. I admit that that was the case. That was primarily due to timelines coming out of legislative council. There are dash one amendments to the bill, and given that, I want to move into a brief work session with the committee's consent. I'm going to adopt the dash one amendments so that they... You know, I understand it. We'll try to get it up. This room is historically difficult to hear, and we can't even hear ourselves from time to time. But we do need your cooperation. We'll try to speak up as much as we possibly can, but I can't do anything with the audio system myself.
There's no mic on.
Is there no mic
there's
on?
No mic.
Jane, is it not working? We are. Can you hear me?
I can't hear. Audio for the tape, but not for the room.
All right. The tape's picking it up, but it's apparently not getting loud enough for...
There.
Any here now? Any here?
Yeah.
All right. No, thank you. Okay? All right. Good. So, with the committee's consent, we'll move into work session on Senate Bill 742. Council, there are amendments to this particular bill. And just briefly describe what they do.
Mr. Chairman, I will. Members of the committee... you should have the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 742. I'll just go through this section by section. In section one, lines six and seven are deleted, and this has to do with the basically the definition of this what would be the new crime of terrorism. It would make the definition if a person knowingly plans, participates in, or carries out any violent act that the person knows or reasonably should know could result in the death or serious physical injury of a person and is intended by at least one participant to substantially disrupt or destroy. And then it goes through, I believe, back to the bill itself, the free and orderly assembly of the inhabitants of the state of Oregon, commerce or the transportation systems of the state of Oregon, or the education or governmental institutions of the state of Oregon or its inhabitants. The rest of Section 1 then goes through the sentencing for this. Section 2 has to do with law enforcement cooperating with federal or state agencies to investigate an act of terrorism and also allows law enforcement to retain information relating to an investigation of terrorism and the sets out that the Attorney General shall adopt rules governing that retention. Section 3 is a section that deals with criminal forfeiture. I would say it's kind of a housekeeping bill, excuse me, section. It adds this crime of terrorism to those that are that criminal forfeiture applies to. And sections 4 and 5 and 6 have to do with this would the way it's been set up by legislative council, this crime would be subject to the parole board. So it have those sections have to do with that. And the last section, Section 8, has to do with putting, because of the long sentence on this, it says that no, because there is a possible a liability for the death penalty, it makes explicit that no juvenile would be subject to that. Excuse me, and I should say it's because of the section that mentions imprisonment for life. So I think legislative council just wanted to make that clear.
All righty then. Talking about the dash one amendment, Senator Burdick, would you be so kind?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just take a brief second to clarify for members of the audience, I'm going to move to adopt the dash one amendments for purposes of discussion only. This does not indicate at this point that the committee approves of the bill or the dash one amendments. It's just to get everything together for purposes of discussion. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would move the dash one amendments.
All right. Senator Burdick moves with that admonition adoption of the dash one amendments. Is there any discussion? There is no discussion. Any objection to the adoption of the dash one amendments? Hearing none. So order. Okay. Now that we're looking at it, Council, do we have copies of the handbook, Rose?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we did have copies of the Dash 1 amendments as they were hand-engrossed. I don't know that we have this many. If I'll make sure we get some more copies on the table.
All right. Can you hear? Just barely? All right.
We can hear everyone else.
All right. Andrea? Do you want to bring up the presenters? You've got, is it Stetsy LaRouche, Dr. Hara, and Ramon. All right. Thank you very much. And if you would begin by just simply stating your name and then telling us what you'd like to tell us.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Stetsy LaRouche, a retired U.S. Army major and currently the president of the Portland chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League. Today, I am not only representing the Portland chapter of the JACL, founded in 1929, one of the oldest Asian civil rights organizations in the country, but also our Asian community as a whole well. Not too long ago, in the past, our rich American history, the Japanese community in Oregon, as you're about to hear, was subjected to being spied upon by our neighbors, which was encouraged by the law enforcement, who would then collect and maintain these files on the Japanese and Japanese Americans, which resulted in internment of over 120,000 people of Japanese descent in the western United States, including my own grandparents. To say that we are concerned community is an understatement. We are concerned to the point of becoming increasingly apprehensive as a core objective of SB 742 introduces a situation that is once again ripe for abuse as it was in the 1940s. As we understand it, SB 742 would allow state and local law enforcement to ignore both ORS 181.575 and ORS 181.850 when investigating terrorism. This is another example of the erosion of our civil liberties as we know it today, as this SB 742 would take away the protection that these laws provide. This is, to our community, a very real concern. It is vital to our security that we strengthen our ability to track and apprehend those who would destroy us. It is equally vital that we provide safeguards against having innocent people targeted, spied upon, and harassed by law enforcement and our government based on their race or ethnic origin. We realize that the events since September 11th has ushered in a new era of vigilance to protect our citizens. However, it is equally important to protect the rights and liberties of those same American citizens. As you know, about a year ago, Attorney General John Ashcroft swept away protections that have been in place since the 1970s, the results of uncovering abuses by the FBI. As concerned involved Oregonians, we share and encourage effective law enforcement to protect the constitutional rights of everyone who lives in Oregon. We embrace our laws which protect against police spying on innocent people and organizations. We embrace our laws which prevent state and local law enforcement agency from targeting people based on their race or ethnic origin when those individuals are not suspected of any criminal activity. The Portland chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League stands in opposition to the passing of SB 742. We do not need a law that broadens the definition of terrorism to the point that it can be applied to almost any criminal activity that further weakens our basic American civil rights.
Ms.
Thank
LaRouche.
You for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Chairman, hang on
a second. You were speaking to portions of the original bill with respect to the broadness of the statute. Have you looked at the amendments, the Dash 1 amendments?
Obviously, I haven't.
All right. I just want to make that clear for the record. Sir, if you would then introduce yourself and then speak.
You'll have to excuse me. One of my infirmities is difficulty hearing, but I'll try the best I can.
All right. You and I have the same problem.
Members of the committee and chairman, my name is George Shigeru-Hara. I was born in Portland, Oregon, 78 years ago, and I'm a retired physician who practiced obstetrics and gynecology in Portland, Oregon for 50 years or so. This year is sort of special because my medical graduating class is having a golden reunion event I'm looking forward to attending. Anyway, I want to start by stating that my father was born in Japan, and at the age of 18 he first came over to America and ended up in the Willapa Bay area in the state of Washington, worked on the oyster farm. He went back to Japan, got married, and started raising a family. However, in 1923, during the great earthquake in Japan, my oldest sister was killed because of injuries received in the earthquake. My other sister and brother died during the childhood illnesses. So my father and mother decided to come back to America and ended up in Portland, Oregon, where they went into the business of running a hotel. This business endeavor was the most common practice of the immigrants who had settled in the cities like Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, and elsewhere. And there were concentrated as many as 79 hotel owners by the Issei people from Japan. And these hotels were located primarily in the Skid Row area in southwest Portland and northwest Portland. And this is where I grew up with my other Japanese friends and their kids and attended school, living in hotel rooms. Now, the grade school I attended was primarily Japanese Americans, the Niseis, and Jewish American kids. And both of these groups did well academically and were well respected by the principal and the teachers. But after school, the Japanese kids would retire down to the Skid Row area, which was home to them, and attend Japanese school and learn the basics of Japanese language. Now, when time came for high school, the atmosphere was different. I chose to enter Washington High School, where most of my classmates went to Lincoln High School. So I was in a brand new environment where the majority of the student body were Caucasians. The first few years were lonely, but I gradually made friends with a Caucasian, and many of these kids came from residential areas like East Lorne, Lawhurst, or Mount Tabor, which were high middle class areas. And as I made friends with these Caucasian students through exchange of information, ideas, I found out that they lived in nice homes with gardens and garages, and they owned cars, and their folks weren't hotel owners. They were occupied in occupations that I was not even familiar with. During my sophomore year, an event happened that really changed my life. I was encouraged to run for the cheerleader position, which was the elective position. So I went to the North Park Box, where the park director was Mr. Art Brody, and he was the chief cheerleader for Oregon State College in Corvallis for the Beavers. And he was most enthusiastic and supportive, and we worked out a routine. The only thing I couldn't manage was do a standing backflip, so we omitted that. And then I went and performed before the student body when he elected chief yell leader of Washington High School. This propelled me into a very visible position, being an Oriental and a predominantly Caucasian student body. And this opened the doors for me, and I was able to become a member of a prestigious boys' club. And in my senior year, I was president and vice president. This really built up my ego, and I felt confident of going on further, and my plans were to enter the University of Oregon in Eugene and then eventually get into medical school to become a doctor, as my parents have been educationally motivated and directed me to become a professional. However, everything came to a halt because of Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1942, and within a relatively short time in February 19th of the following year, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which allowed for the military to evacuate all persons of Japanese ancestry into camps behind barbed wire. And so from my exalted position in the small high school community, as I entered through that gate, I was a nobody. I was a suspect. I was a threat to national security on the West Coast. And my aspirations for the future were completely doused. And after a time, after you lose your freedom, you begin to lose hope and become despondent. But to overcome that, I had basic hope that things would be settled. I didn't know how. One of the ways of trying to get out from that abnormal environment was to apply for work permit to go to Eastern Oregon and work on a sugar beet field. The other alternative I found was to apply for college in the Midwest or the East. And the organization that allowed us to fill out blanks for admission and find schools that might accept you was present. And through that organization, I applied. Meanwhile, from the Portland Assembly Center, we were shipped and railway cars with boarded windows. We couldn't see the scenery, and we finally ended up somewhere in Idaho in a place where they formed a relocation camp for more people of Japanese ancestry. This was a Minidoka relocation camp. My stay there was very limited, for I received notice that I had been accepted, and I chose to go to Ohio Wesleyan, which was in State, Ohio, between Cleveland and Columbus. And I started my pre-medic studies there, did quite well. Then the second event happened during my second year there. A Navy recruiter came around and wanted the pre-medic male students to join the Navy V-12 program. And as he explained it, it was an answer to all my prayers. They would pay your tuition, room, board, and even a salary, and gave you a Navy uniform. You stayed in one of the frat houses, and after you became a doctor, you paid back by service by being in the Navy. I applied. I was one of the first in line that applied. First question, the recruiter looked at me and said, "Are you Japanese?" And I answered positively, and he said, "I'm sorry, the Navy won't accept you. We don't take Japanese." And he said, "Just several weeks ago at University of Ohio in Columbus, Japanese from Hawaii, world-class swimmer, Keio Nakama, showed up, and he was in line, and his request was carried over to Washington, and it confirmed that they couldn't take him into the program. This news of not being able to get into that program probably devastated me more than my initial fact that I was relocated into the Assembly Center. Anyway, I returned back to my parents, not to a hotel in Portland, Oregon, but back to Minidoka behind barbed wire again. But again, I didn't have too much time to sit around and build up an anger. I received a letter from the United States government starting greetings, and I was to report at Fort Douglas from Minidoka and to be inducted into the U.S. Army. They didn't. They were willing to take Japanese. I accepted it eagerly and started this new venture and was sent to Fort Snelling, where a Japanese military language school was located. And previously, they had found out through my records that I can speak Japanese through my experience in the Japanese language school and speaking Japanese at home. Anyway, I was inducted into this program and with a very accelerated course, learning an entirely new kind of Japanese. This was military Japanese language. It was very difficult, and we learned formation and all the structures of the Japanese Army, and we were going into combat to assist, to gather valuable information and question POWs. However, the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and then Nagasaki, and shortly thereafter, Emperor Hirohito gave his famous surrender speech to the nation. And so my hopes of becoming a combat warrior attached to an infantry division smashed, but then I was to be sent as an occupation force, U.S. occupation force, to Japan. It turned out that it was most fortuitous time for me to be in that position. Anyway, my service in Japan allowed me to work at all different levels, and I was able to enjoy the benefits thereof. Soon after, I came back to Portland, started my pre-medics, ended medical school, finished my training, and started my private practice. Meanwhile, I was raising a family, married a Nisei girl. Now, my kids were raised without any of the hang-ups that I had experienced during my high school period. And eventually, my five kids married Caucasians, and they had kids. And all these, I have nine grandkids now, they're all half-brothers. And I use that term, mixed genetic background, as an enduring term and not derogatory. And as a physician, I was able to acquire the material position that put me into a upper middle class status. And so I think this country is great. I'm a lifelong resident with that hiatus of being away. But in spite of the fact that America is great, they have made shameful mistakes, and one of that was the relocation, incarceration of deaf people of Japanese ancestry for military necessity. I think it is all too easy to blame easily identifiable minority groups without powerful political or economic infrastructure pick on them, and for reasons such as military necessity, round them up and put them back into incarceration. And for this reason, I think this bill, SB 742, is very recessive. It's a step backward, and I strongly urge members of the committee not to pass this measure. Thank you very much.
Sir, may I add a point?
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think this testimony is instructive. My father was a veteran of World War II, and he saw action in the Pacific Theater. He was very careful to educate me about the Issei and the Nisei population of this country, especially the story of the decorated 442 division. I represent many Nisei in Ontario, and I think Executive Order 90666 is something that we should be much aware of in this circumstance. Ms. O'Rourke made mention of a comment I'd like to explore a little, Mr. Chairman. She indicated that we should strengthen our ability to track and apprehend those who would destroy us in substance. If this bill, as amended, Senate Bill 742, strikes wide of that mark, how would Ms. Arush recommend that we do, in fact, strengthen our ability to track and apprehend those folks?
Well,
Mr. Chairman.
I understand, Section 2 is still in the bill, in the 181, 575, and 850. Section 2 is still
in Section 2, just for the audience and those watching. Section 2 says notwithstanding ORS 181575 and ORS 181850, a law enforcement agency shall cooperate with the federal or state agency that is investigating an act of terrorism, and a law enforcement agency may retain any information relating to an investigation of terrorism as long as the investigation remains open. And concludes by saying that the Attorney General shall adopt rules governing the retention of such information. So that's the portion that you're speaking to.
Well, Section 2, I think it weakens 181.
How does it do that?
Because it, I believe, allows the law enforcement to, like, keep lists of people and perhaps even profile people.
All right, I understand what you're saying, but
to World War II, lists, like in Hood River, I know they kept track of certain people.
Right.
Neighbors were spying on each other.
Right.
And then so when war broke out, they were able to round up all the people.
I appreciate what you're saying. I don't think that's what it does, but we'll clarify that as we go through the record, and I'm sure that we'll hear from the ACLU and others and get to the fine points as to why some people think it does. And then, Doctor? Have you read the bill? Have you read the bill?
Parts of it, yes.
Parts of it?
And I read the particular police chief Croker's testimony and some of the other ACLU people reasoning for opposing the bill, and I completely agree with that.
Okay, but you haven't read the entire bill? You have not read the bill or the Dash 1 amendment?
He's got the bill. I don't know if he's got time to read it. Have you read the whole bill?
No.
All right. Thank you very much. Ramon.
Yeah, my name is Ramon Ramirez, for the record. I'm president of Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United, PECUN, Oregon's Farm Worker Union. And we represent over 5,000 farm workers, the majority who are immigrant workers from Mexico and Central America. And we stand in opposition to Senate Bill 742. We believe that while this bill is well-intended, that it in fact would hurt the very people it's intended to protect. We're particularly opposed to the repeal of Section 2 that will undo that would of the bill which is 181-850, which prohibited local law enforcement agencies from acting as INS agent, preventing innocent people from being targets because they look foreign. 181-850 does not prevent police agencies from doing their job and actually keeps the community safe because immigrants are able to trust law enforcement and feel safer in reporting crimes. I've been involved in the issue of immigrant rights for the last 30 years. In fact, actually 31 years. I got involved because my brother-in-law got apprehended by a local law enforcement agency and was turned over to the INS when my sister was 6 months pregnant. And that was my introduction to understanding immigration law. And we tried as hard as we could to get him released from INS detention, and we couldn't. So he was eventually deported and didn't see his son for another, I believe, about 5 years. And that's the last time, the first time he's seen his son. But in any event, that's when I got involved 31 years ago on the issue of immigrant rights. I think that in those 31 years, I have been actively involved in immigrant issues, immigrant rights issues, and I have seen a lot of abuse by local law enforcement officials who act as INS agent. In my testimony, I actually have included articles that date back to 1977 to illustrate some of the things that I'm talking about in terms of the abuse. Before passage of 181-850, I witnessed police officers stop and detain Latinos without reasonable cause or suspicion and ask them for their documents. I have also witnessed police agencies set up roadblocks and separate Latinos looking for people, racial profiling people. When they set up these roadblocks, they would separate the white folks from the Latino folks to determine immigration status. And in fact, the creation of 181-850 was a result of a roadblock of a fake accident that was conducted by the Forest Grove, Hillsborough Police Department, along with the INS, to detain immigrant workers from going to work at the Glenn Walters Nursery back in the day, back about 86. And in fact, that resulted in the arrest of about 350 people. And that's what sparked the debate and in our community and the push for the creation of this statute, 181-850. Before 181-850, you couldn't tell the difference between who was an INS agent and who was a police officer out in the fields. Since the passage of 181-850, many community organizations have worked hard with local law enforcement officials and agencies to build trust and confidence and to establish a good working relationship with police. It is a very known fact that if immigrants, victims of crime, feel that the INS will be involved or called in, crimes will go unreported and immigrants will not feel safe giving information to police to help them investigate crimes such as terrorism. We have spent countless of hours sensitizing police departments throughout the state of Oregon. And I just want to point out that the advisory groups, the community and police advisory groups in East Multnomah County, Washington County, and Marion County have done a fantastic job at building that relationship. You know, and those agencies know the importance of building trust and building confidence in the community with their police departments. Because they know firsthand what's going on. And recent conversations with Chief Louis down in Hillsborough, you know, those folks know, you know, all the time that we spent, and that just, you know, repeal of 181-850 as part of
this bill does not repeal that statute.
Well, we feel it does.
Well, it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, we feel it does, and even the proposed amendments. I mean, there's no.
Do you have a copy of the?
That's right. It's
the amendment. Mm-hmm. Okay. Look at section 2 of the bill and speak to that issue, because that seems to be what you're trying to address here. And tell me what you see as the the fundamental flaw is that...
It says, notwithstanding ORS 181-750
right.
and 181-850,
correct.
A law enforcement agency shall cooperate with any federal and state agency that is right. investigating an act of terrorism.
Okay, now tell me, if you will, where it is that local law enforcement should not cooperate with the federal government as it relates to the investigation of the crime of or a crime of terrorism. Where is it that the local government should not cooperate with the federal government?
Well, the difference is this, and this is the same issue that the woman next to me was saying, is that there has been historically, right, there have been records kept on folks. There have been, I myself, for example, been a victim of
Ramon,
that, where I have been put on this, on blacklist
could
by police department
question,
for...
Ramon? Could you answer the question?
Yeah, I'm trying to do
okay,
that.
Okay, the specific
that
question.
I have been victimized because of my work in defending immigrants' rights, right? And I'm not a terrorist,
associated
with any terrorist organization yet.
Ramon, let me restate the question. Where is it that local law enforcement should not cooperate with the federal government as it relates to the crime of terrorism?
Well, I think when it says notwithstanding ORS 181-575 and 181-850, what you're saying there, right, in effect, in my eyes, is that you're trying to repeal that. Those provisions of the law.
Now, the question was, where is it that local governments should not cooperate with the federal government as it relates to the investigation of terrorism? Where should they not cooperate?
That's what I'm saying. Is that in that sentence right there? That's what you're saying, basically. Is that?
I'm asking you for your opinion. When is it that local governments or local police agencies should not cooperate with the federal government as it relates to the investigation of terrorism?
Well, I think police officers are given if you take away or you repeal 181-850, what you're basically sending is a message that it's okay to stop anybody that's foreign looking. It's okay to check whether or not what their immigration status is. It's okay to provide a double standard. You know, and that's done not. How can you tell if somebody is a suspected terrorist if it isn't for foreign appearance or foreign looking? And that's what we're concerned about. We're concerned about a double standard that will be applied. And any repeal or any mentioning of repeal of statute 181-850 will do that.
All right.
That's why we fought for it.
Right. I think I understand what you're saying, and I'm trying to make sure that I understand what your concern is here, because the language doesn't repeal the statute, but it does add additional language that becomes more instructive as it relates to the crime of terrorism. So your concern is that it appears that it creates a double standard with respect to the statutes.
That's correct.
Is that it?
That's correct.
Okay. That's important, I think. Senator Fairley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the whole issue relates to me at least around 181-575. And with your permission, I'll just read the section that I think is problematical. No law enforcement agency as defined by ORS 181.010 may collect or maintain information about the political, religious, or social views, associations or activities of any individual group, association, organization, corporation, business, or partnership, unless such information directly relates to an investigation of criminal activities, mm-hmm. and there are reasonable grounds to suspect that the subject of the information is or may be involved in criminal conduct.
Right.
So the whole point, Mr. Chairman, of 181-575 is to stop or prevent the creation or maintenance of enemies lists, state enemies lists. However, even as the law is written, it suggests that lists may be maintained if there's a clear connection to an ongoing investigation of criminal activity, which would include terrorism. So the notwithstanding provisions in this bill would seem to me to be a question of whether or not we believe that the crime of terrorism is adequately defined in statute and fits within the protections offered by 181-575, or we need to accept the principle of notwithstanding the existence of 181-575. And I think that's the issue that we're here to hear about today. does Section 2 overturn the protections, or does it, in fact, as Ms. O'Rush said, give us the additional ability to strengthen our ability to track and apprehend those that have criminal intent and terrorist intent? So that's what I'm interested in hearing about. And I believe what I've heard from Ramon is that he believes that Section 2 overturns the protections in 181.575. I just want to point out, nothing in the statutes protects someone with criminal intent. So I just want to make sure that we're talking about the Section 2 as it relates to the issue of criminal intent or prevention of just the creation of state enemies lists, which I'm sure we would not support.
All right. Yep, additional. And I think it's important that the distinction that is raised here, because I think it's going to be a central point of the bill. Frankly, it was included in the bill. Whether it enhances or overturns or just does damage to those two statutes, we're going to need to know that as we go through it to make sure that we're doing what's, I think, in the interest of everyone. Sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm an attorney. For about 25 years, I represented farm workers in the state of Oregon, most recently directing the statewide farm worker program. I think I was asked to testify in this panel primarily to talk about the history of the adoption of 850 and the reasons for it. And I'll address that briefly, but I have the sense that I should abbreviate those comments and talk more to the particular question that was just being raised.
Well,
I will do that.
And Michael, I think that would help because we're going to run out of time and people are not going to be happy that we're running out of time. So given the fact that we are going to run out of time, we'll let the committee or the folks present know that we'll set another time to address their concerns or let them testify. So go ahead, Michael.
I would simply say on the historical end of things is that it used to be that those who were in the country in an undocumented status were in sort of an outlaw class, and I hesitate to use that word because I don't mean a criminal class. What I mean is the old English sense of outlaw. By, you know, if you got crosswise of the crown would declare you an outlaw, and then you were outside of the protection of the law. You were just sort of, you know, if something happened to you, you couldn't do anything about it because you were out of the law. That was kind of what the situation was before, is that although undocumented people in theory were protected by laws against theft and assault and that sort of thing, in practicality what happened was because of their fear of the police, they justified fear in many, many jurisdictions, they were simply unable to seek protection from police agencies. We don't want to go back there because what that means is that it means a couple things. One is it means that people will not cooperate with law enforcement in terms of investigation of law. And secondly, it means that people having no resort to law, it turns out to be like the Wild West. People have to protect themselves and defend themselves, and they get arms to do that and do whatever they can. And that's not something that's conducive to the kind of community you want to live in. I won't say any more about that unless people have particular questions about that. We don't want to put people back in a situation where they feel that the law is not there for them when they are victims of a crime, even if they happen to be in an undocumented status. I want to turn to the question about why people are concerned about this bill from this perspective. Because if you look at Section 2, there's a way to read it that it is superfluous to the statute today. Because the statute today, as I understand it, does not prevent law enforcement from investigating a crime under any circumstances, or cooperating with federal law enforcement in the investigation of a crime. So the notwithstanding, read that way, does no damage to the statute, because the statute, in fact, says that now. As we understood it when it was being proposed, and as I think police agencies generally understand it. However, we're not writing on a blank slate. You know, we had the business with Portland and then other agencies joining in where there was a request not to investigate lawful, not to investigate unlawful activity, but rather to conduct an investigation of a group of people based upon their ethnicity, very little else, and to ask lots of questions about their status. Now, I understand different people saw it different ways, and it was kind of on the fence, and one way or another. I can tell you that in the immigrant community, the perception was that the law worked to protect the innocent from being essentially stereotyped by basis, in this case, it happened to be Arab ancestry, but earlier witnesses can show this. This can strike anyone who's a little bit different, depending on the concerns of the time. So the question is, what is it that's changing in the light of this history, and what is it that requires this change of statute, and how might a court read it in a way that does violence to those values that were put by the legislature in 181-850? And if you look at Section 2, it says, a law enforcement agency shall cooperate with federal state in investigating an act of terrorism. And no one, I think, would say, generally, in the common usage of the term, an act of terrorism is something that isn't a crime and that isn't investigatable. But then we go to the definition of terrorism.
And you're looking at the dash one.
Yeah, and the dash ones are helpful, substantially helpful, and I commend the authors of them for addressing these issues, but it still leaves some cause for concern because basically it leaves it being that someone carries out terrorism if they participate in or
thus knowingly plans, participates in, or carries out any violent act that the person knows.
I'm losing the dash.
Okay, you're losing it.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you don't. There you go.
I'm sorry. I got confused there.
That the person knows or reasonably should know, and then it goes on.
It's a peculiar definition because it leaves one in the position of knowingly plan something that involves as an element something that someone else, one other person, intends. And it's not clear to me whether the knowing applies to knowing that the other person intends, or it's knowing that you're planning an act. That's a concern because if we're getting to any plans that someone in the group may have some secret desire to cause serious harm.
I don't think that's the intent. The intent is not that you have one participant. Could you be quiet, please?
Well, my suggestion was, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Well, I was going to say the intent is not to have one part of a group have a secret plan. This is, as it's written, is supposed to, and maybe it doesn't do a good job of it, that the other individuals present would also know that there's intent.
Well, I suggest to the chair and to the members of the committee that it can be read that way, and if it is read that way, then in the backdrop of the changes proposed for 850, then it begins to be really a concern. Then it begins to say, when a group gets together and meets, if you can find someone that says it was their plan to cause serious harm, that justifies investigation and investigation for any act, because presumably it would justify investigation of the plan, of the planning process itself. And it seems to me that goes too far.
So you would segregate out the planning process and an act of terrorism and not allow that to be investigated?
I would not define an act of terrorism as being...
As the plan to commit the terrorism?
As a plan to commit something that someone else intends.
Okay. All right. Senator Ringley.
And I would appreciate the counsel's opinion on this, but once we start to talk about planning, that's covered by conspiracy, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So do we add anything by including the word plan in this statute that wouldn't already be contained in our conspiracy statute?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, let me get the definition of conspiracy, and I can read it for the committee. Conspiracy would be the crime when someone is planning a crime that is not followed through on, and I can get you the definition.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just had one other question. I'd appreciate the counsel's comments, or perhaps yours, Mr. Dale. The way that the word terrorism is described, it says, the last part of it says, is intended by at least one participant to substantially disrupt or destroy. And I'm wondering what that refers to. The disrupt or destroy, is that the government? Is that?
Well, I think you have to read beyond that. It says the free or orderly assembly of inhabitants of the state of Oregon, commerce and transportation system of the state of Oregon, educational government institutions, those elements.
I see. I wasn't tracking the cut and paste. Yeah, thank you.
Right. Comments, Mr. Dill?
Well, I would point out that to disrupt or destroy commerce is a strike, something that disrupts commerce.
Under this bill, it would be only if you intended that someone would be seriously physically injured or killed.
Only if one person. That's the kind of concern we have. Is if one person in a group.
Just hang on a second. I'm going to accept one more outburst, at the very most, and we're going to clear the room. Okay. One more outburst, the room gets cleared, we shut down. Mr. Dale.
I guess the point I was making is that. It would require only that one person in the group intended violence or serious injury, and that's problematic.
Right. All right. All right, and I understand what you're saying with respect to that one person, if it's isolated. I didn't read it that way, and it wasn't intent, but okay. Other questions? No? We have one person who's come from more than 100 miles away, and I want to get that person on if I can. Yes. I'm sorry. I understand. Is there a Pamela by?
Thank you.
Thank you. If Pamela Bai is in the overflow room, I'd ask that she come up and try to get her on. She's the only person that indicated that she came from more than 100 miles.
I came from over 100 miles away.
And what is your name?
Patty Caldwell.
I'm sorry?
Patty Caldwell.
Caldwell?
I'm marked off 100 miles.
Okay. Well, I've got a ton of people here, so. Patty, you want to come on up? Yes, you did. Good. Come on up. Patty, if you just state your name for the record and then proceed.
My name is Patty Caldwell. I live in towards Welch's, Oregon, up towards Mount Hood. I'm a certified lactation consultant and in private practice. I'm a single mother. I come here today representing myself, my family, my mother's here, and my community who feels like I do. I come here as American, patriot. I strongly oppose all parts of Senate Bill 742 because it violates Amendment 1 of the Bill of Rights that my forefathers established for their future generations, so that a government would never oppose us and that we would be in control of our destiny. Their struggle was difficult and many lives were lost in the struggle, and it's my turn now to keep it intact. I would like to read the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights of the United States. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for the redress of grievances. These are sad and frightening times for Americans because we have at last experienced what most all other countries in the world have tasted: terrorism to our own people here and on our land. Webster's Dictionary says of terrorism as the systematic use of terror as a means of corrosion. Terror, says Webster's Dictionary, means a state of intense fear, one that inspires fear or a reign of terror. I see the bill and the Patriot Act 1 and 2, which just passed, as a direct act to control and reign terror over the people of this great free country. And I believe, as many Americans do, that we are living in the McCarthy era all over again. You can raise your eyebrows. Anyone who objects to the power and commands from the president are considered a traitor, and I've been called this by standing up from what I believe in, or sympathizer of the ones who are responsible for September 11th tragedy. Just as the people of the McCarthy era spoke out and demonstrated, they shut down the motion picture industry and other businesses as a statement of disapproval of how our government was spreading terror and fear and accusing and imprisoning anyone who spoke out against the government's wishes. So are we now disapproving of what our government is doing? Then you were called a communist, and now you are labeled a terrorist sympathizer. If it were not for those brave black and white brothers and sisters who shut down the transportation systems in Alabama and whose massive marches variably shut down businesses, education, and governments, they would not have been recognized as having a grievance. The government did not recognize them till then. They exercised their First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. The union workers of our time died for the rights to have fair wage and healthy and safe workplace. If it weren't for their terrorist acts described in Senate Bill 742, and I've read the revision, by the way, and it was very unfair that we got it on Saturday, our wages would not have been what they are today, and we would still lose lives on the job. This is what we are doing when we take to the streets, as I have with thousands and millions of other Americans throughout this country. The time has come to say no to a government who wants to control us and use the act of terrorism done to us as a smokescreen to justify taking away our First Amendment rights so that it can do what it wants without any opposition from its people. It's time that we the people take our country back. Thank you for letting me speak from my heart, and I ask all of you to listen to your hearts and to uphold our freedom and keep this democracy for my children, your children, me, so we can be proud of it. Don't let this bill go any further than it has gone today. Thank you. If you'd like to ask me any question, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question.
Certainly.
You say you've read the bill and you've read the.
Well, I studied it. I've had it for a month. Well, I've had it for since it came out. And the revision, by the way, I wanted to comment. The revision, I think it's very. I don't know how government runs, but none of us here were aware of this amendment. And I have my computer on every day, right. And it wasn't there on Friday, and I prepared this, and I took time from my business,
right.
And now you're telling us that,
did
and
you,
everybody's scrambling.
Did you
so
want
I think
to respond to a question?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, you read the Bill of Rights, First Amendment, and the free exercise of people to peacefully assemble. Could you please connect for me how it is that people might peacefully assemble and then do what's described as terrorism in the bill?
Well, what I'm understanding is that you get a crowd of 15 or 20 or 30 or San Francisco, 250,000 people sometimes back in the Vietnam War days, you know? So out of those people, how many people do you think are going to do something? How many people do you think are going to come into the crowd and maybe start trouble? Maybe they're on substance or something. Now, what I'm seeing by that bill, and the amendment, I saw that, but there's nothing in there, and this is the reason I'm against the whole thing. Because when you have a massive amount of people together, there's going to be some act of terrorism. But to condemn the whole group of that, this is very, very wrong. Very wrong.
Look, I don't understand exactly what you just said. You said when there was a mass of people together that there's going to be terrorism?
Well, I understood that if there's two people, there has to be two people. And a lady has borrowed the original. But there has to be two people within the crowd in order for it to be called an act of terrorism, some kind of violence, shutting down a highway.
Well, that could result in a death or serious physical injury.
Exactly.
In a person.
Exactly.
So you're suggesting that it's permissible to have a large group of individuals and those individuals intend, or the result might be that someone might
Well, die. I read about the black movement. I'm talking about the union workers.
Right.
I'm talking about my forefathers.
Right.
Yes,
right.
Thank you.
I grew up in that era, and I'm familiar with Martin Luther King, and Martin Luther King's basic premise was peace.
That's right.
And peace
so are ours.
So how help me understand how it is that Martin Luther King's movement would be brought up in this bill if it was to occur today.
I'm talking about the First Amendment rights here.
I understand.
Okay. And this thing is wide open. It's making it so that two people out of a huge crowd can condemn the whole crowd.
Right. All right, thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Question.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think the question that I need to have explored is the difference between civil disobedience and criminal actions. What is the difference in your mind?
Well, this bill is very vague, and that's what we want to know. I think it shouldn't even be here. We should have read a different bill, maybe.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not asking you about the bill. I'm asking you about just in your value system as a citizen, what is the difference between civil disobedience and criminal action?
Civil disobedience. I don't know. Breaking the speed limit, getting a ticket, breaking the law, going over 50 miles an hour if it says 50. Criminal action would be coming in my house and raping my daughter. Would be turning over somebody's car in a riot.
Mr. Chairman, the illustration that I'm thinking of that's probably fresh in people's minds is the assembly in Portland, where for the most part the demonstrations were in fact peaceful, with the exception of the hammer tossed through the window of the McDonald's. And that to me is a fairly clear example of the difference between the right of peaceable assembly and the act of riot. And so the issue here is, from what I see inside this bill, in order to prove the charges in this bill, you have to also prove the criminal intent of the organizers to create acts of violence that could reasonably assume to injure people or create the threat against life for law enforcement agents, for safety and security workers, or for citizens. And so I guess I'm trying to get, in my mind, clear where that clear line between the ordinary and lawful exercise of First Amendment rights and the criminal action that may result from a conspiracy. We know that in our society there are folks who would have advocated destruction of property.
Correct.
And threats to human life, even encouraging attack on military and civil installations, and I refer to the latest communications from PETA. So I just want to hear you articulate, in your mind, there is a difference between
yes.
civil disobedience and peaceful assembly and acts of criminal action, and even further, the conspiracy to commit criminal activity.
Yes.
Is there clear distinctions?
Sure, but there has to be more discussion because of the terrorist acts 1 and 2 make it very, very vague for a lot of people. And that's just been kind of pushed through on us. So there has to be more discussion. I don't know how we could push these bills through without more discussion because things are different now. Things are so different now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Senator Farioli, what Ms. Caldwell was attempting to say is that is a fine line. And, for instance, when the war broke out and there were protests all across the state and in the city of Portland and it spilled over into Interstate 5, I don't believe that the protesters started out with the intent to spill over into Interstate 5, which under this bill could be interpreted as knowing or reasonably should know that it could result in death or serious physical injury because cars could have hit people or crashed into one another. So I think that is what you were attempting to address in your comments.
Yes.
Is that not true?
That's true. Thank you.
All right. Thank
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
I think that argument is persuasive, but then I have to connect the coordination through the use of text messaging of activities that happened within that protest. And I'm curious about, you know, more than just communication, how much of that was directed, how much of that was pre-planned, how much of that was intentional. We're lucky, in fact, that there were no injuries or deaths associated with the occupation of the interstates. That's a dangerous business, and I can see that people who were in that crowd, if that had occurred, might have a higher degree of liability. Although I don't think a prosecutor could prove that there was an intent connected with that occurrence if it should have occurred. So I'm not persuaded that the
I'm not persuaded,
Mr. Chairman, that the issue is being explored here, and that's the intentional, premeditated criminal activity that is terrorism, which is the subject of this bill.
May I say something? I've been a peace activist. I kind of quit for a while because I married a doctor, but I was in the Vietnam War. I was one of the ones that brought the boys back. I had friends that died there. My boyfriend was in the Navy there. And so I'm back now. I'm back again. I'm back for a good reason. But I've met people there, the large coalitions. There was about 100 of them. And I met one lady. She was active when I was active. And, you know, what we're concerned about is communicating over computers and things like this. And she was more surprised than I was about the freeway shutdown. I've never known this. I've never known this to happen, okay? But everyone that I run into, and I was there, I signed petitions. I talked to hundreds of people. And there was not one. And you know, I'm 51. We were saying to all the young people, please, no violence, because this spreads. The movement is wonderful. It's peaceful. And we want it to stay that way. But as I said before, there are a few in a crowd. When you get thousands and thousands of people together, there are a few that are using substance abuse. There are young people. And these things can happen. I don't know how you could take that out of it. We're humans. We're human beings.
Right. And actually, Ms. Caldwell, I think your point's well taken. I think the issue here is the intent of the bill, at least the writer of the bill, me, was not to include some incidental behavior that occurs as a result of a gathering.
Well, it was open. It's a very open bill.
And that's why we're having a hearing, so we can deal with many of these issues. So I do appreciate the comments. Thank you. Thank you for letting me speak.
Chairman.
You bet. Absolutely. There was one lady, Ms. Bai, who it looked like she signed up and then scratched her name out, but I'm not really sure. She hasn't come up, so we'll scratch her off. David Benenghi? Oh, I'm sorry. You want to come in here and talk?
Yes, great. We'd like to. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Floyd Przonski, State Representative, House District 8. I wanted to just come and just a couple of the speakers before me have actually brought up some of the concerns I had. I will gloss over those as to Section 1 and Section 2. I would like to call the committee's attention to the Dash 1 as to the new definition that would be on lines 4 through 7 as to defining what is terrorism. I would ask the committee to be very cautious in the language that's being used. I wonder if we actually have a definition in statute for any violent act. I believe this is something that the committee would want to be very cautious about, because when you look at the original bill, and that's what I had prepared for, I received the dash ones this morning, that basically you have crimes that would be currently charged at as a disorderly conduct that could in fact be the predicate for an act that would be defined as terrorism if those other elements now under the dash ones are met. I think the example of I-5 is a good one. Not only did it happen in Portland this last week, but about 2 or 3 years ago, there was a similar incident that occurred outside of the city of Eugene. We do have today, you'll hear from, if time permits, two individuals, Captain Becky Hansen, who's with the Eugene Police Department, as well as Dr. Lenore Couture, who serves with me on the Eugene Police Commission. I know that they are going to be bringing up other issues, so I will gloss over those. The last one I want to make sure the committee's aware of, the attorney who spoke before me raised it, and that is in Section 2, as to whether or not Section 2 is even necessary, because it appears that all of us agree that the law enforcement does, in fact, have the authority now to investigate any criminal activities, notwithstanding the prohibitions that are set forth in 181. And from my drafting of bills through legislative counsel, they have cautioned me before as to including something that would basically be already permitted by statute and setting it out in a specific statute that it may be interpreted by the courts as having a limiting effect on what officers or law enforcement in this case could actually do in another situation. So it could be that the court may say that the only thing at this point that the law enforcement would be able to assist in would be in the investigation of terrorism as compared to any other criminal activity. At least that's my understanding of how it's been. I've been briefed by legislative counsel. With those comments, I will give the other individuals that are here an opportunity to speak unless there's some questions.
Questions? Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying, Representative Kuzanski. I appreciate your focusing in on the any violent act, and I guess I'd like to pose a hypothetical to you. Let's say there were a large crowd and somebody somewhere in the middle of the crowd threw a rock, say, at police officers. Or might throwing a rock be considered a violent act, at least the way you read this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, yes, I do. Okay. I will tell you that one of the things in my work on the Eugene Police Commission, I had the opportunity to actually chair a committee on use of force. We looked at a lot of different issues as to how it involves our officers involving and with their involvement with instances in the community as to the concerns and the perceptions and desires of the community as well as the needs of the law enforcement. Our concern, of course, is to make certain that individuals have the right to assemble, free speech, object to a government policy in the sense of having redress or protest. And you do, in fact, many times have civil disobedience is what I think most of us in this room would define as an act that may be against the law, such as blocking a street. And then at the same time, when you look at the definition as it's currently written, when you have someone that's within this larger group carrying out some other type of act that could be defined as violent, such as throwing a rock, which did in fact result in injury or death to somebody, then the question really is everyone that's within that set subject to being charged with terrorism? And if I could, Mr. Chair, I would just say for Senator Ferraioli, as a prosecutor for the last 14 years, it may be something that I would have a difficult in proving these type of these acts. The question really is, do we want to have individuals who are basically exercising their freedom, their privileges under the U.S. as well as the Oregon Constitution being subject as a defendant and being required to hire an attorney to defend them from those type of acts?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator.
Representative Kuzanski, I appreciate your comments, and I especially appreciate your bringing the prosecutor's perspective. I guess my comments were related to the idea that inherent in the section one of the act, I believe, is premeditation and criminal intent. It says that a person would knowingly plan, participate, or carry out a violent action. And to me, that is a predisposition toward the violent action that triggers the idea that this statute could be used in prosecution.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fiorilli, I would ask you to look at it this way. When you look at how the language on line 4 on the dash 1s now reads, it says participates in, then jump over, any violent act. It doesn't say that that individual actually has to be the person that's conducting the violent act that could reasonably be known to cause injury. I think that we just need to make sure that if this bill is going to go forward, that the definitions that are actually being used are going to capture the individuals who I think we both would agree on that were actually carrying out those acts of criminality as compared to someone that may be participating in a larger group that could somehow be swept into the definition.
Mr. Chairman, that does in fact deal with the issue for me of premeditation and state of mind, and I think that needs to be explicit in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Prozanski, you brought up the issue of violent act. I had passed a note to our council earlier this morning asking if that definition was in statute, and it is not. So I agree with your points about that. The other issue that came to my mind is Eugene has a reputation, sometimes sordid, sometimes good, sometimes positive. But we have had a series of riots in recent years, and rioting is already covered under the statutes, as I understand it. Is that not correct?
That's correct. There is a crime of riot.
Okay, so truly, how would you distinguish between riot and this statute if this statute was enacted as it currently is?
Well, I don't know if you necessarily could, or without the, I'd need to have the statutes in front of me to give you a distinction. The reality is you could potentially have individuals being charged with both of the offenses of rioting as well as terrorism, depending on the actual conduct that took place.
All right. Thank you.
Mr.
Senator Fairley.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Prozanski again in his role as a prosecutor, is there any doubt in your mind that there are members of our community that are in fact planning violent actions against governmental targets or public buildings or private enterprises that in fact would fit the definition of terrorism? Is there any doubt that that's occurring in our communities?
Senator Chairman, Senator Farioli, absolutely not. That definitely is occurring. I mean, officers in our community as well as communities around this state and around this country have in fact been investigating and actually have in some cases actually infiltrated groups that are in fact their predisposition is to cause physical injury if not death to individuals in their acts. But that in itself, both of us would agree, is what we were attempting to capture, I would assume, in this type of a new charge or new criminal activity that's been defined as terrorism. The question really is who else under the current definition or language that's being used that's going to potentially be encompassed by that, which we would say should not be.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to join Senator Ringo in thanking Representative Prozanski for his testimony.
So Representative, I've got a question for you, being an attorney and worked with me in judiciary committees before. Would you, on line 7 of the hand endorsed bill, tell me what you think substantially disrupt or destroy means?
Mr. Chair, I guess that's going to be up for the viewer of the interpretation of that statute. I would also, I think, mention that is probably something that we would want to be more clearly set forth, because what I may believe is substantially disrupt may not be the threshold that the chair would have or anyone else on this committee, let alone a jury. I guess the best example I could give to you that's most immediate in time, Mr. Chair, is what has occurred in this room on two occasions since I've been here. There have been individuals who, for whatever reasons, have decided to show their appreciation for statements that have been made. They have, in that point, have had what I would consider an outburst that is an emotional one that they probably did not intend to disrupt, but for someone that's conducting the business of this body, knowing the time frame, could in fact find that to be disruptive.
But again, understand that's a de minimis view of the word, clearly, or the phrase. You, I assume, would consider substantially disrupt or destroy the use of an incendiary device to destroy a public building to be substantial.
Absolutely.
All right. So it's just interesting. I think that the intent of the bill as drafted is not to focus on the de minimis, although I think your comments are instructive. The objective here is to look at something substantial, something with respect that is on parallel to treason, something literally that attempts to shut down the University of Oregon for the purpose of destroying its very function.
Mr. Chair, I agree. I know the chair's intent was that, because I know, knowing the penalties that would be assessed in such cases, that you were not looking at trying to capture the minor de minimis type of conduct. But as you well know from your practice, that courts many times will interpret it based on the way they see it. And so I think we want to make sure we have the directions and the guidance that are necessary so it's not misinterpreted.
And the bill is drafted, assumes a presumptive 25 years in prison as a sentence. In your experience as a prosecutor, how seriously do you think the courts take that potential sentence?
Well, I guess it's going to depend on how it's set up, in the sense of this is not, at this point, going to be what I guess I would consider a Measure 11 type of offense, where the court would not have discretion. If this is going to go into the sentencing guidelines, then you're going to potentially have the other components to it. Now, from my first reading of the original bill, it did look like it did have a minimum on there.
This would not go into guidelines. This
would be equivalent
to the parole board. So the presumptive sentence would be life in prison. And I guess the question is, how serious would a judge take that with respect to some of the de minimis examples given?
I guess it would depend on who he or she, in the sense of the individual wearing the black robe as the judge.
No judge in my county.
Yeah, and I think it would depend. I will tell you this. If you are looking at cases where individuals have been sentenced to somewhat of an extended period of time, there are cases that came out of Eugene which resulted in a dealership having a number of vehicles that had been burned, and the judge in that case, if I'm not mistaken, was Judge Valer, and my understanding, the person that was sentenced in that case received 20-plus years. I'm not sure exactly. So I think it's going to depend on whoever's wearing the robe and what they believe is appropriate.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions for Representative Brzezinski, Senator Farrell?
Yeah, just this question I've asked of many other witnesses. In the case in Eugene, there's a clear distinction between civil disobedience and the criminal action. But I have the sense that many citizens are confused about the definition or the extent of civil disobedience. I have the clear impression that many citizens still feel that arson is an act of civil disobedience. I just wondered if you'd care to comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrioli, I guess, again, it's these to try to interpret or represent what an individual may think is the threshold of where they step over as to what is or isn't civil disobedience would be very hard for me to do. You're correct. There are many individuals in this state, not only in Eugene, that do have different thresholds than what you or I may have, that may believe that because of their cause, that certain acts that we would see as being true criminal and very, very serious, and the results could in fact result in serious injury or death, may not deem that to be the case. But, you know, that's, I guess, their prerogative, and then I would expect that if they were caught up in such conduct and if they were prosecuted, they would be held accountable for that conduct under our laws of this state.
Mr. Chairman, that is, I think, at the crux of this issue. Civil disobedience is not in the mind of the beholder, and it's incumbent on us in the legislature to define what are the limitations of civil disobedience and what are the thresholds of criminality.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, Senator Farrelly, my statement is that you and I may take the attempt to define what civil disobedience is, and we may in fact believe that we have a clear, bright line definition. There may be others that believe that we are wrong, and they may go beyond that, but clearly once they've crossed that threshold that you and I have set, they are in fact accountable under our laws for civil disobedience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I wasn't going to talk at all today to give people a chance to testify, but I can't resist. Civil disobedience. I'm sorry. Civil disobedience does not speak to the nature of the crime. Any crime can be civil disobedience. What civil disobedience is it's committing an action knowing that you face consequences. That's it. It could be anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Floyd. David, you ready? And others?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I believe copies of my testimony will be distributed to you. Also being distributed is a, and by the way, on the back sheet of my testimony are the language of RS 181.575 and 181.850.
We
already
have copies of this.
Great. Also being distributed is a list of more than 60 organizations who are part of the coalition to preserve those two statutes. And we're also circulating to the committee letters from Portland Police Chief Croker in opposition to any weakening of the two 181 statutes. A letter from Multnomah County Sheriff Bernie Giusto along the same lines to Andrew Meyer of our staff, and written testimony from Attorney Richard Ginsburg. Mr. Chair, I will not read my written testimony. It's there for the record. I want to address a number of points that have been made this morning, and I'd like to start with Section 2 of the bill. As we read Section 2, it creates an exception to the two 181 statutes. Notwithstanding 181.575 and 181.850. In other words, for the purposes of this section, it is as if those two laws do not exist. That's the way we read it, Mr. Chair. That a law enforcement agency is required to cooperate with federal or state authorities that are investigating an act of terrorism. And this section does not refer back to the other section of the bill and its definition of the crime of terrorism. So as we read this section, whatever the federal government said was an investigation of terrorism, a state or local law enforcement agency would be required to participate
and cooperate
in that investigation and could violate the rules that they would otherwise be required to abide by in RS 181.575 and 181.850. And, Mr. Chair, it's already been referred to earlier, but these two statutes came about because of abuses by federal and state and local police for a good part of the last century. I have with me this morning a copy of the file that the Portland office of the FBI had on the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. It is several hundred pages long. Some of the earliest stuff in the file dates back as far as 1942.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
This point, because Section 2 goes on to say that the Attorney General shall adopt rules governing the retention of such information. Now, that is envisioned to be a check on that very issue, and no one's addressed that so far.
Mr. Chair, we don't see it as a check, because currently the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, in which numerous local police agencies and the Oregon State Police are part of that task force, is doing investigations, for the most part, we hope, of suspected criminal activity, but under the new guidelines adopted by Attorney General Ashcroft, the FBI and other federal agencies can investigate political organizations, religious organizations, even if there is no evidence of criminal activity.
Hold on, David. You just put Attorney General Ashcroft, who's the U.S. Attorney. This speaks to the state's Attorney General.
I understand that, but my point, Mr. Chair, is that the investigations that are being carried out by the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, everyone who's participating in that task force is not creating local files. They are creating FBI files. Those files are not subject to any, that information is gathered, that information is not subject to restrictions of Oregon law, is not required to be purged as, and let me give you a specific example. In any criminal investigation, law enforcement is going to investigate individuals against whom it has some suspicion, but later finds out to be innocent. Under the current Oregon law, it's okay to collect those files, to do that investigation, as long as there is a reason to believe that that individual may be involved in criminal activity. But later, after that person has been ruled out as a criminal, if those records are state records or local police records, they are required to be purged if they relate to the political, religious, or social activities of that individual or organization. So under this bill, those files could be kept as long as the Oregon Attorney General says they may be kept. If those records become FBI files, they will be kept for at least 10 years and possibly in perpetuity. And it won't matter if they are FBI records what the Oregon Attorney General says about them. Under current law, state and local police, at least at the front end, are required to comply with the provisions of ORS 181.575. In other words, the Portland police, the Eugene police, may not investigate somebody or an organization against whom they have no reason to believe there is any criminal activity or even may be involved in criminal activity. We believe the current law allows investigations whenever there is any evidence of criminal activity or any suspicion, any reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. This bill will allow investigations when there is no evidence, when there is not even any suspicion of criminal activity, and it will allow investigation of...
Hang on, David.
Right.
You know how the process works here. Senator Walker's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fedanke, I'm trying to recollect, but it seems to me sometime in the interim, perhaps over the last summer, I was getting an email indicating that the Portland police had maintained records on a number of organizations, not for any particular reason. Is that something that happened recently? And if so, how could that have happened in the event of 181.855?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I believe what you heard about was the results of an investigation by the Portland Tribune, which uncovered records dating as far back as the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s of literally hundreds of organizations in the Portland area and some of them outside the Portland area. Peace House in Ashland was among the groups. The Fallen Angel Choir was among the groups. I have a list of them in my testimony. If that's what you heard about, those were not recent activities of the Portland Police Bureau.
But, Mr. Chair, could I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
Though they may not have been recent activities, but the records were still being maintained in violation of the statute.
Well,
is that correct?
Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, those records had been back in the mid-'80s when Penny Harrington was chief of the Portland Police Bureau. She ordered any political intelligence files to be destroyed and split up the police intelligence division. And at that time, one of the officers who had been with the intelligence division for many years took his pickup truck down to his office, loaded up dozens and dozens of boxes of these files, and photographs of individuals and took them to his private property rather than allowing them to be destroyed. He stole those files and kept them on his private property. He died just a few years after that, and it was his family members who turned over the files to the Portland Tribune last year. So they were not being maintained at that time by the Portland Police Bureau. However, among those files was some very interesting information, because we had been given a copy of the ACLU file that the Portland Intelligence Division, at least what we thought was the entire file, back in 1975. And we were assured by Police Chief Bruce Baker at the time that this activity was going to cease and that we were being given everything that was in the ACLU file that the Intelligence Division had, except for material that would tend to disclose the identity of confidential informants or sources of investigations, and that those materials had been shredded. Well, we got a new file that was in the material that the Portland Tribune got access to last fall. And in this file was material, not only material that had been turned over to us, but material before 1975 that had not been given to us, as well as material that was collected after 1975. And some of the material that was collected on other organizations by the Intelligence Division even occurred in violation of 181.575 after it was approved by the legislature in 1981. You know, we've been arguing for years that there's a need for more oversight of this activity, this kind of activity.
And David?
Yeah.
How is oversight accomplished now?
In the city of Portland, which does more oversight than most jurisdictions, the city attorney's office, in conjunction with Richard Rosenthal of the Independent Auditor's Office, review police intelligence files on a quarterly basis.
Is the Attorney General's office?
The Attorney General's office has administrative rules that govern the retention of files and the collection of files in conjunction with the Attorney General's office, Criminal Intelligence Division, which deals with organized crime, gangs, and terrorist activity. I'm sure there's someone from the Attorney General's office who could give you more information about that. We are quite pleased with the Oregon administrative rules governing that activity. Unfortunately, since 9/11, most of the police intelligence activity that's going on in the state of Oregon is being done in conjunction with the FBI. And as I mentioned earlier, the files related to terrorism that are collected in conjunction with the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force are FBI files and are not subject to the administrative rules of the Attorney General or the review that is done on a quarterly basis by the Portland City Attorney or the Portland City Auditor's Office. I hope that was clear.
Well,
Mr. Chair.
It is. I'm trying to, because I agree with you. I guess my personal opinion is that records that are no longer of value relevant to a criminal investigation ought to be purged or destroyed. And I guess the one of the reasons the Attorney General adopting rules governing retention is in the bill is because that is my opinion, that police agencies ought not retain information that is no longer germane or relevant to a criminal investigation. So those rules now promulgated by which agency?
Well,
the Secretary of State or the
Attorney General's rules only apply, as I understand it, to the files that it shares with local law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. That are gathered in their computers and paper files here in Salem or in other offices of the State Department of Justice. Those rules do not apply to the files of the FBI.
Right. And so your concern about this particular section is that information that might be garnered and in conjunction with federal agencies, that even though we may have controls on a state level, we would lose control by virtue of connecting that with the federal government. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe that loss of control has already occurred because as a condition of cooperation with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, the FBI is insisting that all state and local agencies compile their information on FBI forms that then become the property of the FBI and out of the reach of this statute. There is still some important protections provided by 181.575 and 181.850, because at least at the front end, before that information is collected, state and local police are required to ask the question, am I investigating someone, am I collecting information about someone against whom I have a reasonable suspicion they may be involved in criminal activity? The FBI, in general, now under the new Attorney General guidelines, is not required to make even that initial assessment in its investigations. And as I read this section, Oregon law enforcement agencies would no longer be required to make that assessment if they were told by federal authorities they were involved in a terrorism investigation.
Mm-hmm. All right, I see what you're saying. All right. Any other questions? Susan?
Good morning, members of the committee. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Lawyers Association, and we're here in opposition of Senate Bill 742 and the approach it adopts to this problem. Senate Bill 742 is an extremely broadly drafted provision. Even as amended, it incorporates a vast array of conduct and may elevate disorderly conduct to the crime of terrorism in a mandatory life prison sentence under specific circumstances. There are a multitude of problems with the bill, and I'm going to limit my comments to the Dash 1 amendments. Senate Bill 742 doesn't require an intent to injure, only that the person knows or reasonably should know that a violent act could result in death or serious physical injury. It doesn't require that injury actually occur. It also doesn't also requires only that a person knowingly plans, participates, or carries out any violent act. It doesn't require that the defendant be involved in planning. We've talked, Senator Farioli has talked previously about his concern of sort of premeditation or planning. There is no such requirement, nor does it require that the defendant actually carry out the act of violence his or herself. The term violent act is not defined. It is likely that violent act would include property damage, such as criminal mischief, a misdemeanor crime. It may also include crimes such as reckless burning, also a misdemeanor crime. Senate Bill 742 would elevate such misdemeanor conduct as breaking a shop window or setting a small fire to a life sentence whenever one of the participants intends to substantially disrupt free and orderly assembly, commerce or transportation, or education or governmental institutions. Many of the protesters arrested last week in Portland for misdemeanor conduct may have qualified for prosecution under Senate Bill 742 and could be facing mandatory life prison sentences. There were claims in the press, these cases have not been resolved and are still pending, that some of the participants threw items through windows of fast food restaurants. There were allegations that materials were burned during the protest, and also that an officer was injured when debris was thrown from a bridge. Senate Bill 742 incorporates as a mental state that the person knows, and here are the words of extreme concern, reasonably should know that the violent act could result in death or serious physical injury. In a different context, the Oregon Supreme Court has struck down similar language that allowed a jury to apply an objective or what's been termed a reasonable man standard in determining criminal culpability. In State versus Corrales, the court held that a finding of either actual knowledge or a belief by the defendant that the property was stolen is essential to a conviction for theft by receiving. An instruction that the defendant had reason to know or good reason to know was held insufficient. Senate Bill 742 attempts to create a general all-encompassing crime of terrorism. This contrasts with the approach adopted elsewhere in Senate Bill 24, which has already been before your committee. Senate Bill 24 creates the crime of unlawful development, manufacture, delivery, possession, or use of a harmful substance, toxin, or delivery system. It also creates the crime, an enhanced crime, of circulating a false threat of fire, explosion, catastrophe, or other emergency likely to cause harm. We do not oppose the approach adopted in Senate Bill 24 and have assisted in drafting its amendments. Creating new crimes to fill gaps in existing law, such as Senate Bill 24 has attempted to do, is a preferable approach to law reform than targeting criminal conduct, not because of the intended harm or the harm actually created, but the intended purpose or political objectives involved. Senate Bill 742's approach is simply that. In doing so, in trying to create this sort of general crime of terrorism, it contrasts with law reform efforts in other areas, such as the eco-sabotage field, where new crimes were enacted, such as unlawful tree spiking, interference with agricultural operations, or research, rather than a general crime of eco-sabotage. Likewise, it contrasts with the racketeering statutes, which aggravates violations of pre-existing criminal law under circumstances and elevates them to a Class A felony. In our opinion, adequate criminal penalties exist under current Oregon law and federal law to cover any purported act of terrorism or conspiracy to commit those acts. Senate Bill 742 will be subject to serious constitutional challenges, in our opinion, because the sole basis for enhancing the penalties of the criminal conduct involved is the otherwise politically protected objective of the actor. That's not to say that their act, the criminal act itself, is protected, but that their objectives are. It is likely to criminalize a vast array of diverse conduct involved in political demonstrations, potentially union strike activity, any situation where a violent act occurs. Criminal law should punish the conduct, not the political purpose of the actor. Likewise, and finally, with respect to the amendments of ORS 181.575 and ORS 181.850, in our opinion, that amendment, Section 2, is unnecessary. Neither provision under ORS 181 prohibits the investigation of an act of terrorism. ORS 181.850 prohibits the state police from acting where the only crime violation is a violation of federal immigration laws. ORS 181.575 similarly prohibits collecting and maintaining information where it is not related to the investigation of a criminal activity. Neither of those provisions prohibits the police from acting where there is a reasonable suspicion of criminal violations other than immigration violations. We have a concern with the language, in addition to it being unnecessary, that Section 2 is so broadly defined by giving a general directive to law enforcement agencies that they shall cooperate with the federal government in investigating acts of terrorism, that we're sort of having Oregon officers being required to follow the directive of the federal government, irrespective of how they may be approaching that issue. It could require officers arresting persons solely because of their immigration status, if directed by the federal investigators, or from participating in forms of racial profiling, where there is absolutely no suspicion of criminal activity and where this state and its officers have made clear that that is not their purpose in investigating criminal activity. And those are my comments.
Yes, quite stellar comments. Thank you very much. Lynn Crater. You're broken. Now you have to buy it.
Not quite. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Crider. I am research director for the Oregon AFL-CIO. I am an attorney, but I'm not a criminal lawyer, so I'm struggling, as maybe some of the members of the committee are.
Have you ever been a prosecutor? That would be a no.
I have not been prosecuted. The Oregon AFL-CIO opposes the bill, the original bill, and the bill with the dash one amendments. I'd like to speak briefly to each, to Section 1 and Section 2 of the bill. Beginning with Section 1, we are particularly concerned that this language will chill legitimate union activity. And
Section 1? No, you're speaking to Section 1 of the amended bill.
Correct.
All right.
Yes.
T-
Tell me how would it do that?
The section defines terrorism.
Right.
The problem is, I'd like to go through it. We believe that we have the crimes to deal with the actual harms.
Right,
that,
but Lynn,
that go
we're over time here, and I'm going to have to shut it down. But how is it that this section?
Let me give you an example, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, good, do that.
I am going to. I think there's been good questions raised about who has to engage in the violent act that then makes others guilty of terrorism. But I'm going to assume that the individual charged has to have actually done a violent act. And I have to tell you that it happens sometimes in otherwise peaceful activity. For example, I've been on, some years ago in Eastern Oregon, I was, as attorney for a labor union, on a picket line at a sawmill. Peaceful picket line, we were going back and forth across notifying folks that were coming in and out that there was a strike. Clearly our intent was to disrupt commerce. That's what a strike is all about, is trying to stop the economic activity from happening so that we put pressure on the employer. That's what we do. It's absolutely legal. The question is there a violent act that happens? And what I would say to you is sometimes a violent act happens in that strike, that picket line that I was on.
Hang on a second. You're not reading the entire statute. You're an attorney, right? Look, it says a violent act that the person knows or reasonably should know could result in the death or serious physical injury of the person. That isn't to be read separately. They're together. It's part of an entire sentence.
I understand that, but what we're trying to do in this picket line is to stop trucks from taking logs in and out of that sawmill.
Right.
Somebody throws a rock at that truck. It's not likely to cause serious injury, but it could cause serious injury. It's not a good thing. I'm not saying it shouldn't be a crime when that happens, as it did on that picket line that I was standing on. But that would be a fairly minor criminal offense. We are now defining that as terrorism and making it punishable life by life imprisonment. My argument to you is not that you haven't defined something that might legitimately be a crime and probably is a crime. The question is one of proportionality. You have a whole sweep of activities that you've defined as terrorism, from that guy who gets emotional on the picket line and throws a rock at a truck that could hurt somebody seriously, although he didn't intend to, and in fact he didn't hurt anyone seriously. But that person is guilty of the same offense, punishable by the same life imprisonment as somebody who tries to blow up a Max car line or does blow up a Max car line and kill a bunch of folks. We need the existing body of criminal law creates proportionality that I think this bill, even as amended, Mr. Chairman, would do away with. And I think that creates an unfair impact on people, as well as perhaps a chilling effect on legitimate activity.
All right.
Briefly on Section 2, I just want to say that I would agree with David Fedanke's interpretation of that section. That is, that it creates, when terrorism is being investigated by the federal government, it takes us out of the restrictions of 181. And I want to suggest that if those restrictions are good, and we believe that they are good restrictions on law enforcement activity and file maintenance and so forth, then those rules ought to apply across the board. Just as rules against admission of forced confessions fly without regard to the criminal activity that's being charged, similarly the restraints on law enforcement activity that exist in statute should apply regardless of the crime that is involved. I do not have written testimony, however, I do have a copy of a resolution adopted by the Oregon AFL-CIO Executive Board with respect to the 181 laws and supporting maintenance of those intact, which I will provide to the committee.
All
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Sure. And if I could just make a comment, because I've got to go to another meeting, but I just want to say that I really appreciate all the people that came that are in this hearing room and the other hearing rooms, and I have received a ton of emails relating to this bill. I think you've made your voices loud and clear, Chair Minnis, that your goal in bringing this is very appropriate, and so I don't mean to be critical by any means, but I think this is overbroad, and there's a lot of work we need to do on that. But I just want to thank everybody that took the time to come to Salem and participate. I mean that sincerely.
Yes, I agree, Senator Rego. Thank you very much. We are about 15 minutes over the time in which we were supposed to conclude and give this meeting room up, so we're going to go ahead and adjourn, and we'll hold another public hearing at some other future date.